week of August 1st, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 65, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And I hate to brag, but at the home of actor Paul Rudd, who just invited me over for dinner, I'm Michael Giltz.
What?
Yes. Oh, I mean, I interviewed Paul Rudd for a story, and we talked, and he said that he was having dinner with some friends, and he wanted to bring me along because if I came with him, he was sure to win. And then he said, no, I mean, I'm sure to have a really good time if you come with me. So I'm at his house now, and then I said, I have to do a podcast. And he said, you do a podcast? And I said, yes. He said, perfect. Do it during dinner. So I'm at his house at dinner doing the podcast.
Well, thank Mr. Rudd for us for allowing you to come over and record today's episode. We've got a lot of news to cover today. We're going to begin with Daniel Frankel of The Wrap, who wrote a post on the Twitter effect and how Twitter is affecting Hollywood movies and television shows, or is it? We'll also be covering a plethora of television news with the TCAs happening this week and last week. There are some big news stories coming out of those press conferences, including a big story about American Idol, which if you haven't heard by now, you're probably just waking up from a coma, and one story about, or several stories about ABC. We'll also be discussing some music news, specifically some music news about Michael Giltz's favorite band, the Black Eyed Peas, before we talk about a little ruling that the U.S. Copyright Office gave out last week that will affect everyone who owns an iPhone. Of course, we'll do our lightning round, Big Deal or Big Whoop, where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week, and we'll wind up with a little inside baseball featuring Richard Branson. But first, as always, we turn it over to Michael Giltz, entertainment journalist extraordinaire, who will fill us in on the weekend's top box office earners. Michael, take it away.
The number one movie for the third weekend in a row is Inception, which grossed $27.5 million. It's about to approach $200 million, and it is officially Leonardo DiCaprio's biggest hit ever, other than Titanic. The number two movie of the week is Dinner for Schmucks with Paul Rudd. Hey, that's Paul. And Steve Carell, which grossed $23.3 million. Number three is Salt, the Angelina Jolie movie, which dropped about 45%. It grossed $19 million. It's made about $70 million total. Number four is another Steve Carell film, Despicable Me, which grossed $15 million. And is now at $190 million total. He also had Date Night earlier this year. He might be the biggest star in Hollywood at the moment, or certainly the most bankable. And number five, the biggest flop of the week probably, is Cats and Dogs, The Revenge of Kitty Galore, $12.5 million. That's a total for a movie that cost $85 million. It's probably going to drop quickly because word of mouth has been terrible. It's in 3D, of course. And number six is Charlie St. Cloud, the movie Zac Efron decided to make instead of Footloose, bizarrely, and that grossed $12.1 million. Number seven, Toy Story 3, which is slowing down, but it's at $389 million, about to hit $400 million. Grown Ups, the Adam Sandler movie, also losing steam. It's at $150 million total. The Sorcerer's Apprentice, another flop this summer, which is at $51 million total. And at number 10, the Twilight Saga Eclipse, which is at $288 million, just about to equal the gross of the last Twilight Saga movie, which is exactly where we told you it would be when it debuted.
And it's made $356 million overseas. I mean, that is just a powerhouse of a franchise. That just rakes in money.
I'll bet they were wishing there were five books in the series rather than just four.
Well, aren't they thinking of turning the fourth book into two movies?
Yes, they are doing that. Just like the Harry Potter movies being split into two versions, the final Twilight Saga book, which is not that long, they're somehow breaking that up into two movies as well just to try and eke out every penny that they can. Did you guys see any movies this weekend?
I saw Salt.
Did it need pepper?
It, there was plenty of pepper, trust me. I definitely want to be Evelyn Salt when I grow up. Angelina Jolie makes a really good badass. But I kind of went back and forth between being really entertained and just horrifically bored. my friend that I saw it with loved the whole way through. She's like, I was never bored. And I was like, funny, because I was bored at least five times. I was sufficiently bored.
Well, do you agree with what Patrick Goldstein of the Los Angeles Times said about Salt? He compared Salt to Wanted, and he said if you compared the two movies, since they are so eminently comparable, you'd have to say that this is yet another example in which trying to recapture the same excitement and revitalize the same action beats doesn't inspire an overwhelmingly positive audience response. You just can't go back to the well that many times. And I guess he's saying, there's actually Angelina Jolie action fatigue.
No, I think that's sexist. I don't think that Wanted and Salt have anything at all in common except for the fact that she stars in them.
The point of a good movie is that you don't need to have bigger and bigger stunts for every movie. As long as there are real characters that you're excited about, somebody jumping out of a car is exciting if you care about the character. If you don't and it's unbelievable, it doesn't matter how many stunts you have in a movie.
Wait, Karen, why do you call it sexist?
Well, because if, let's say, Tom Cruise had been in Salt the way he was originally supposed to be, and he had had an action movie, 3 years ago that was similar, do you think that Patrick Goldstein would be even writing about this? No.
How are Salt and Wanted familiar other than the fact that she stars in them?
I mean, one is about
a person who might be a child groomed from birth to become an assassin for Russia. The other one is based on a graphic novel about a teams of assassins that, you know, I mean, they just don't seem related.
Wait. You just said that basically the whole story revolves around assassins both times.
And they both start. That's half the movies made in Hollywood. So does The Bourne Identity. So does James Bond. So does, you know, a million other movies.
Yeah, I mean, Patrick Goldstein would never have written this piece if it had been about a male action star. Never. It would have been one thing if Wanted had come out earlier this year. But Wanted came out, 3 years ago?
I thought it was an interesting comparison. I don't necessarily
Why?
Know that. I thought it was sexist. I thought it was interesting because when I saw the trailers and the advanced footage for Salt, I thought, wow, it's kind of like Wanted.
Why? Why did you think that?
Well, let's see. Angelina Jolie and an action film about assassins. It's not that hard. It's not that much of a stretch.
She doesn't play an assassin necessarily she plays a Russian deep mole for Russia.
Was the whole thing a dream, though? Because if so, then it would have reminded me of Inception. Which, by the way, it's earned 3 times its opening weekend gross.
Right, that's a multiple. It's a sort of a rule of thumb lately in Hollywood that if you gross your opening weekend, you should gross 3 times whatever that was. You know, assuming it's a wide release, to be a movie with good word of mouth and a movie that's doing well. And obviously, this movie hasn't even slowed down yet. It's having terrific grosses during weekdays. It's grossing tens of millions of dollars during the week, and it's still chugging along. So, you know, when all is said and done, it could gross 4 or 5 times its opening weekend, and that's the sign of a movie that people are really loving.
That it's doing well on the weekdays. I find that interesting.
Well, it is summer.
Yeah, people are going to it every day of the week. I mean, it is the end of summer, of course. School's starting up soon. So every day is an opportunity to make a lot of money. But it's definitely the one that's shining during the week.
It's even doing well overseas. It's made $53.7 million.
Well, it's gonna be up for a lot of Oscars, at least in the technical awards. And since they have 10 movies nominated, it probably deserves to be nominated for Best Picture. It's definitely one of the success stories of the year.
Yes, as is Toy Story, which has made $436.4 million overseas.
Well, it's one of the most beloved franchises of all time, and each movie has been as well reviewed as the one before it. It's well deserved that something that successful can do that well. Has it passed Finding Nemo yet? I believe $826 million total. Finding Nemo made 866. So in about 2 weeks, it will pass Finding Nemo and be the highest grossing Pixar film of all time worldwide.
Well, did either of you take a look at the Inception Toy Story 3 trailer mashup that somebody put together?
No.
There was a link on Screen Crave, and what they did was they took the trailer for Inception and took the audio out of that and laid it over the images from Toy Story 3's trailer. And it cuts together perfectly. Ken is playing the Leonardo DiCaprio character. Well, Michael and Karen, I found that link for the Inception Toy Story 3 mashup on Twitter, and it took me to Screen Crave. But there was an interesting story in The Wrap this past week that got a lot of both Twitter traffic and, of course, blog traffic, called The Twitter Effect. It was written by Daniel Frankel, who we've had here on the program before. Of course, he is a reporter for The Wrap, and he wrote a post called The Twitter Effect Isn't What Hollywood Thought, and we have Daniel Frankel for a few minutes in between TCA meetings and press conferences, and we'll explain a little bit about what the TCA is a little later on during the episode. But Daniel, thank you for joining us.
Sure.
Now, last year, I guess you wrote a piece on The Twitter Effect after Sacha Baron Cohen's comedy Bruno tumbled more than 36% in its first 24 hours. It was all blamed on Twitter, and the Twitter effect was, that phrase was coined.
Sure. It was actually my boss, our editor-in-chief and founder, Sharon Waxman. You know, Twitter had been talked about, and there was this growing suspicion that, you know, social networks and mobile communications technology was accelerating word of mouth in general. But Twitter was the hot new platform, and, you know, I think, you know, Bruno cratered from when, you know, its opening on Friday, which I think it was 14.4 million. It went down to like 8.8 million. And everybody said, well, you know, it was a bad movie, and everybody must have Twittered the fact that they didn't like it to their friends. And then there you go. A theory was born.
Now, a year later, though, that this little trend of Twitter affecting the box office, it seems to not have panned out so well.
Well, I wouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think there is something definitely to the notion that modern-day communications and the speed of mobile technology, everything from texting to Facebook to Twitter, it all has an impact. But this, the idea that it is single-handedly, you know, cratering movies in one day in mass was kind of overblown. The idea that it would be just one platform, i.e. Twitter, was kind of overblown. It's, you know, a little bit more nuanced than that.
What really scared the studios was the idea that when they had a turkey, they knew they could at least get an opening weekend out of it, and now it looks like that might be shortened to an opening day.
I think it has an impact, but it's not the impact that sort of the impending game changer that everybody expected.
Is there something that's a game changer?
I think they're finding that Twitter is an effective platform. I mean, for one thing, its user base, registered user base, was somewhere below 50 million in the summer of 2009. When this term Twitter effect got coined.
Yeah, it was 50 million.
It's 125 million, I think, now. It's going a lot more impactful. The user base is full of the movie-going demographic. There's a lot of tastemakers there. And if anything, it's kind of emerging as an advertising platform and something that you can harvest and utilize as opposed to sort of fear and be reactive to.
Yes, you pointed out here that the studios are actually quite pleased with purchasing trending topics. That's the tactic they're taking now. I guess Toy Story 3 did it, Despicable Me, Universal did it for Despicable Me, Sony did it for The Karate Kid, and you mentioned that Sony says the interaction rate on their promoted tweets was higher than they'd ever seen, specifically on banner advertisings. It was a 6% interaction rate, and Sony said, well, on a banner ad, it's like 0.0, who knows? It's not even 1%. Is this a trend that you think will increase?
Well, you know, it's just a pilot program right now. It's you know, they haven't officially rolled it out, and I don't know what the impression cost is for the studios. I think it's relatively inexpensive, but if it, you know, continues to roll out and develop, I would imagine that based on early returns, you know, an increasing portion of marketing spend from the studios will definitely be into that.
One of the topics you pointed out and ideas you pointed out was that Twitter is a great way for studios to kind of take the pulse, I believe is the phrase you used, of what movie audiences think of their film. And in years past, that had been done through tracking, but that's become more and more unreliable. And with Twitter, they're getting more of a direct line to the consumer, to the point where two Hewlett-Packard, I guess, computer engineers came up with an algorithm in which they could track a movie's mentions on Twitter and then come up with a predicted gross that's within 97.3% accurate. Now, how in the world are they doing that?
Well, it's funny. Previously, the most predictive force in the movie business was the Hollywood Stock Exchange, which was a, you know, precursor to an investment company's effort, Cantor Fitzgerald, to launch a movie futures trading system. So you have the best and the brightest taking, you know, tracking from multiple firms, you know, kind of aggregating the research and coming up with a fairly predictive model that was, I think, over 90% accurate. This latest research from these two guys at HP Labs in Silicon Valley is even greater, even more predictive. They basically had two different studies. One is pre-release, one is the week after the movie, and they just monitored, you know, what was being said, how much was being said, the kind of quantitative and qualitative analysis on tweets. And came up with this model that I think was in excess of 96% accurate in terms of what the movie would do its first weekend and its second weekend. So studios are taking notice of that. And Twitter is sort of, while they found that they can't really control what's being tweeted outside of purchasing tweets, obviously, they can get a beat on in terms of how the marketer is reacting, and, you know, through the traditional marketing mechanisms, control the message that way, which is really what tracking is all about.
But those two engineers at what was it?
Hewlett-Packard.
Hewlett-Packard. They weren't measuring whether these mentions were positive or negative, were they? They were just measuring mentions.
You might be right about that. In terms of the specifics of their formula, you know, I didn't, you know, I relied on cursory knowledge of what they're doing, but you might be correct.
Now, do you agree with what Patrick Goldstein said in his column? He wrote, and I'm quoting here, "In Hollywood, enormous amounts of energy are expended finding ways to shift the blame for bad movies away from the people who made them to irrational factors affecting the people who actually had to watch them in the theaters." So he's saying last year this Twitter effect was blamed for all these bad movies as a way of studio executives saying, "It's not my fault, it's Twitter. It's those people who are seeing our movies." I mean, do you buy that?
Shoot the messenger, or yeah, I don't. I mean, I think even proponents of social media and believers in its potential concede that one of the people we talked to in the story, Gordon Pattison, who's functioned as a, you know, high level marketing official in Hollywood for, you know, over a decade.
I've known him for 12 years since he started at New Line, I believe, and he's been Mr. New Media.
Yeah, the quote of my story, you know, it's maybe you have it in front of me, but basically it's, you know, Twitter doesn't cause a bad movie to fail. A bad movie causes people to tweet about it, and vice versa. It's, you know, it's the product has to be good.
But I think your original point about the Twitter effect and really social media in general is true, that in the old days you'd have to wait till Monday morning at the office to find out what your friends thought of a movie or your coworkers. And then cell phones happen and texting and Facebook and Twitter. And now you're finding out Friday night, Saturday morning. So that can only have an effect when you make your decision on what movie to go to Saturday night. So it is something that's going to, you know, can accelerate things a little bit.
But it is also more than just Twitter, right? I mean,
right, it's social media.
You can't just say, yeah, it's social media. It's mobile devices, right?
It's texting, it's email, it's Facebook, it's everything.
Yeah, so calling it the Twitter effect is really a misnomer.
Yeah, it's really kind of a semantic argument at that point, but I think it was OTX, the big tracking firm, did a study last year, and this was mentioned in a Patrick Goldstein story that of some note last fall. They measured among moviegoers what social networking platforms and what mobile communication mechanisms they most often use. You know, Facebook usage, MySpace usage dwarfed Twitter at the time, and I think Gordon Pattison found that texting is maybe even the most prevalent form of family member, friend to friend communication. Although there's no way to measure it, but
no, Twitter is only like 11% of the U.S. population.
But I think, you know, it's still, as an industry, movie marketing is trying to cope with the digital age. I think that there's still a belief among some that you can kind of control the kind of alchemy that happens in social media and on the internet. But, you know, I think the conclusion—it's been tried before. I can't think of examples off the top of my head, but I think the conclusion inevitably is that you can't. You can only service information the best way you can, provide the best product, and get out of the way.
Well, certainly we'll get out of your way. I know you're quite busy. You're attending the Television Critics Association press tour.
Yeah, it was Fox and American Idol today. They said nothing. It was a big trip to find out nothing. So you know, thanks for having me on and let me babble for 20 minutes. So it was fun.
Oh, the pleasure was ours. Thank you very much. Well, that was very nice of Daniel to join us. He and I have been going back and forth all day via email because he's attending the Television Critics Association press tour, which I believe still takes place in Pasadena each year. And I believe it also takes place over the course of 2 weeks. It's a very long press event, and each day is devoted to another network or two presenting their new shows and bringing the stars of those shows to talk to the press. And a lot of news has come out of that over the past week, specifically two stories, one of which was mentioned by Daniel.
What was the big news? What was the big news?
Yeah, I'm kind of burying the lead here. You're absolutely right. So I don't know where to begin with what the big news was. There's two big stories. One is that Ellen DeGeneres has resigned from American Idol, and it was her own choice.
Which I believe.
Which absolutely. I believe too. Now, what I don't watch American Idol, But what do you two think of this?
I know that I said this before she even started. It was a terrible idea. And she realized it about 3 months ago, she said, and wanted out ever since.
Michael, what do you think?
I thought she got better and better as the season went on. But I think, you know, taking her at her word as far as realizing she just didn't enjoy critiquing people, didn't enjoy saying that was not good, that this made her unhappy every night, that she made the right decision. But there have been some news reports like implying that, oh, the judges were sneering at her and ignoring her. It's malarkey. As the season went on, she got better and better. They started to echo what she said more. She became her own person. She definitely became more comfortable and you know, did the comedy in better with what she was doing, but she ultimately realized not that she had to be Simon, but she didn't like to say anything negative about anyone. She didn't want to do that, even at a Paula level, and she decided to walk away. I think they would have been happy to have her stay on, but having her leave obviously opens wide all sorts of possibilities. Three judges, four judges, and there's a million names being floated around there. The one that seems most definite is Jennifer Lopez.
That's a rumor. It still hasn't been confirmed, and in fact, Peter Rice, the head of the Fox Network, said at the TCAs today that all of the rumors are, well, some of them are true and accurate, but most are wildly inaccurate. And I would imagine that the rumor that he's referring to is the fact that Steven Tyler might be one of the judges. Steven Tyler,
it's a terrible idea. Terrible idea.
Yeah, I don't think he could speak coherently.
No, yeah. You know, but there's lots of names in the mix. The idea that Cara DioGuardi might be out is a big rumor, and I think that's very likely.
What? But why? I actually didn't mind her.
Right, but I think the sense of saying, hey, we need a fresh start. Nobody really loved her. She didn't get great Q ratings. I don't think people were really into her. So even if she did a fine job, why not? If you can get two big names, go back to three judges. You know, why not? Just, you know, clear the slate. I mean, I would even get rid of Randy Jackson. He's done a great, you know, he's fine. But I think they're too scared to do that.
And if Nigel Lithgow comes back, he's already said that he wants to replace everybody.
Now, you should explain who Nigel Lithgow is. He was the former producer of American Idol, and he's back.
Yeah, he created it with
Is he officially back? I mean,
I
know they
so.
Were still working on the details. But he's also has his own show, So You Think You Can Dance, which I'm a big fan of. Go Kent. And Nigel Lithgow has said, go Kent. He'd get rid of all of them, which I think is a great idea, frankly. You know, not that I have anything against Randy Jackson or Cara particularly. It's just, you know, if Alan's gone and Simon's gone, why not just shake it up completely?
Well, Cara DioGuardi is, from what I understand, gone, right?
It's not official.
They didn't pick up her contract.
I think it is official, but it just wasn't as big news as Alan.
That's interesting. And I think back to three judges is a good idea. I'm just shocked now. That means they have two opening slots, even if they only have three judges, and yet they're still not returning my phone calls.
And they would be calling you to get advice on who to hire?
A judge on American Idol.
Oh. Yeah.
Such an obvious choice.
But they know, look, they went with Ellen once, right? And they said, look, she has a talk show that's a weekly daily talk show. We don't want
daily talk show.
Yeah, I know. I was hoping nobody would pick up on that. They didn't want to, again, turn to somebody who had responsibilities like you do, Michael.
That's true.
You know, you have this weekly entertainment news podcast that's well-loved and well-liked and well-listened to. And
fans all over the world.
Right. And, okay, now that part's not a joke. We do have people from all over the world who are probably wondering, why should we care about American Idol?
It's a big show format all over the world. Everyone knows American Idol. And it's the number one show in the country, and it will be again, perhaps, next season. But there's other big news in television, which is less flippant and less fun.
Well, yeah. I mean, but it was also somewhat expected. A lot of people felt like, you know, ABC didn't really recover from the loss of Lost, no pun intended.
Oh, I love how you're going to try and spin this as the guy was outed because ABC wasn't doing well. Okay, go on.
Yeah, no, this is all about him being fired because of sexual harassment, not because the ABC was in trouble.
You are totally stepping over the head, all over the headline here.
All right.
You're burying the, well, no, actually, you guys should explain what happened.
Well, ABC announced that Steve McPherson was stepping down from the network. And then the next day we found out that beyond whatever problems ABC was having with as a network, he was facing an internal sexual harassment investigation that had multiple harassment complaints involving him, several women, including executives and on-air talent. Included emails. I mean, it was just witnesses. It was just a very, very ugly situation. And There you go. He's out at the network.
And he, what was he, president?
Well, yeah, we should explain that he was, I guess, president and head of creative, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. He's the guy that helps put together the network schedule.
Right.
Yeah, he was the guy.
He was the top dog.
It's a huge deal. And I don't know if you were going to make a joke when you started to say, well, it's no surprise because Lost. But this has absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with how well or how not well ABC was doing. This is a guy who was outed for sexual harassment. I find it fascinating.
And you must be obviously they found there was a lot of credibility to the charges to fire him before suspending him or investigating. Clearly wasn't complete or whatever. So clearly there was a lot of evidence piled up against him, and they just cut him loose. That doesn't always happen in Hollywood. Usually they try to pay off the people or kick them out or make excuses or blah, blah, blah. I'm going to go into sex rehab. Instead, they just fired him. That's got to be a refreshing change of pace, assuming it's all true.
Well, okay. Yeah. And what you just said is very, very important, because Kim Masters over at The Hollywood Reporter is who broke this story, along with James Hildebrand of the Live Feed blog. And they kind of wrote this piece together. And then she kind of alluded to it in the first post. But then there was a solo post about this accusation that an unnamed source, she did not name either the solo source, and at one point she said sources, said that, you know, he had been asked to leave because of these sexual harassment issues. Everybody jumped all over this story, and yet there's really no corroboration.
Well, again, let's clarify. Somebody implied that LA Times and New York Times would never go with a story with only one source. No, that's not true. It depends on the source and their closeness to the information. You know, if your only source is President Obama, well, then you would go with the story if you thought he knew what he was talking about. So it's a dangerous thing to do, but you like to have multiple corroboration. But if this person has direct knowledge of something and they're a credible source that you've worked with many times, there are situations where you would say, I'm going to go ahead with the story. They also did, of course, call ABC for comment, et cetera, and things like that. But, you know, and obviously nobody's refuted and said it's not true. ABC hasn't come forward and said, no, he wasn't fired for sexual harassment. So
they have repeated the same claim over and over again that he resigned and they're going their separate ways. And they accepted it. Right.
They have not disputed the comments made in the article.
That is correct. And
which to me is sort of like taking the fifth. It's like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
I agree. If you've got one source who is incredibly reliable, you go with it. And Kim Masters has been doing this for a long time.
Right.
She's no rookie. She would never have reported something like this if her source wasn't credible.
Right. It could be wrong, but she went with it. She went with it on good standards. Whereas some, anonymous website we never heard of, we would take issue with it a lot more.
Right. And what's interesting is that solo post in which she lays out the claim, her name was taken off of it. James Hildebrand's name was left on it. And it no longer has the Hollywood Reporter banner on it. It's like this weird...
Really?
Yeah, it's this weird copy and paste. It's hard to even figure out where you've linked to.
So what do you think that means?
Well, okay, a couple of things. First of all, I should say I really do respect Kim Masters. Her show, The Business on KCRW, is a must listen to, along with this show, of course. But I guess Stephen McPherson's pit bull litigator, as he was referred to in Deadline, Marty Singer, faxed over a letter to The Hollywood Reporter asking them to apologize. And he said, quote, it appears that with a new editor and publisher, THR is adopting a tabloid-like behavior.
Well, that's what his lawyer should say. But Nikki Fink of Deadline Hollywood said that her sources say that his resignation was voluntary and had absolutely nothing to do with the probe. In which case, why the hell would you resign?
Yeah, what?
You know, we did just allude to a new leader over there at The Hollywood Reporter. As we've mentioned here on Showbiz Sandbox in a previous episode, Janice Min, who used to run and be the publisher or editor of Us Weekly. I can't remember.
Not the publisher.
She was the editor of Us Weekly. She is the editorial director now of The Hollywood Reporter, and they hired Kim Masters specifically to bring exclusive stories to The Hollywood Reporter just like this. But I think the story for the media is that The Hollywood Reporter, which is a venerable trade publication, is now running kind of controversial.
That's not a controversial story. A person resigning from a major television network over sexual harassment charges
isn't like
this guy did cocaine in a bathroom on the weekend. That's a serious story about a serious topic that everybody covering the television beat should cover.
Yeah, I totally agree. This is not Us Weekly stuff at all. And it's,
right. But on Sperling's defense, I will say if Hollywood Reporter has backed off of it and taken Kim Astor's byline off and
that's
sort of abandoned it a little bit online, that's very telling. And so we'll have to keep an eye on why that is and what's going on. Again, it's very difficult because someone gets accused. You kind of think, oh, it must be true. It's not true necessarily. You got to wait and see what happens. It's not fair to assume they're guilty any more than it's fair to assume someone's lying just because they make this charge that's hard to prove.
Well, but with McPherson, I think the story, at least within the media, has been the fact that nobody's talking about Variety and we're all talking about The Hollywood Reporter.
Well, The Hollywood Reporter isn't behind a paywall.
Did we mention the fact that Paul Lee from ABC Family took over as...
Yeah, I was just going to say, I want to talk about that because I find that actually a really good choice. He's done some amazing things with ABC Family.
He has, actually.
He's done The Secret Life of the American Teenager. He's done Greek, which I really like a lot. What else is he did? Kyle XY. What else has he done?
He just makes good stuff that we like. Of course, a lot of it's kind of young adult stuff. But so I'd be curious.
That's okay in this day and age.
Yeah, no, it's true. But I mean, you would not have seen Lost, for example, on ABC Family. It's almost kind of a CW-like. So I'd be curious to see how he does with more older fare, you know, fare for older people. But I think it's a good choice.
Paul Lee looked absolutely thrilled to be taking over ABC. Every picture of him, he was like beaming ear to ear.
I would be so stressed.
I know.
I'd be like, damn it, I'm not flying under the radar anymore.
I'd be like, I don't want this, take it. Although it does come with a lot of power. And of course, with power comes, with great power
responsibility.
Comes great responsibility. Yeah. To steal a line from Spider-Man.
Well, but, she said it's like the CW in a way, and that's true. And I think we'll see that reflected in ABC, them going after that younger demo, getting back to sort of its family roots. ABC for a while had that Family Friday block and family programming. So it'll be interesting to see, rather than try to push the envelope, whether they try and go family friendly and female.
Well, another piece of news coming out of the TCAs. I mean, there was so much news coming out of the TCAs. Why do I keep stepping on all of my headlines here? Steve Carell, it has been confirmed by NBC, will be leaving The Office after, I guess, this year. His contract is up this year. And Angela Bromstead, NBC's president of Primetime Entertainment, acknowledged that the network has been preparing for a future without Mr. Carell. Karen, do you think the show is going to survive without Steve Carell?
I can see it surviving for maybe a season based on Jim and Pam.
It's barely survived with Steve Carell. It's a very, very modest hit. They should be pulling the plug anyway. It's a shame that they're not.
So you're saying Steve Carell leaves, it has jumped the shark.
No, creatively might be fine. It's just a very, very modest show, creative, commercially, and it's at the end of its run, and they should just call it a day and gracefully walk away.
Who do you think could be brought in as not necessarily a Steve Carell, well, let's call a spade, a Steve Carell replacement, somebody to take over that role, the head of The Office?
This has been all over a lot of the entertainment magazines. They've brought up John Lithgow, Amy Ryan coming back.
Amy Ryan's not a bad idea. And John
she was really funny.
Yeah.
They're both really good ideas.
I just don't care.
Do you care about Eminem?
Sure.
Of course, you have to care about him. He's, I think, his fifth week in a row on top of the album charts. He sold his album Recovery. And by the way, nice little segue into music news here. His album Recovery sold 187,000 copies last week to top the charts. And he beat out all the newcomers, including Rick Ross's Teflon Don, which sold 176,000 copies. Not bad. The reason I'm talking about all of this is just so that I can mention to Michael that his favorite group in the world, Black Eyed Peas, they hit a huge milestone this past week. Their song, I Got a Feeling, now has been downloaded 6 million times, which is the most any song has ever been downloaded. It was number one for, I guess, 14 weeks. And it's become the first song to reach that 6 million mark in digital downloads. I'm sure we can count Michael out of the running for having downloaded it even once.
Oh, come on. How else do you think he learned the words?
Yeah, no, there's so many difficult words to learn. It's just a change in how we consume music. It's back to the 50s and the 60s where people bought singles and EPs and went to see an artist on tour and maybe they'd buy the album. So, Eminem is lucky to have sold about 2 million copies of his album. Whereas Black Eyed Peas is one of the biggest acts in the world, and they're selling 6 million copies of their single. It's a huge amount, however it's delivered. Whether you sell a CD or a cassette or a 45 or a digital download, that is a lot of singles.
I just love the way Will.i.am, who is one of the members of the group, is so modest about it. I mean, he's like very humble, and the group is very successful, and They're known internationally. And he said it, so modestly, we came out in 98 and our career, if you would look at it on the chart, there's no dips in it.
They keep getting bigger, baby.
For our career to still be healthy and vibrant and doing things like 6 million downloads, it's pretty significant. This is a guy who is constantly patting himself on the back.
He's about as modest as Kanye West.
Oh, good.
Ooh, segue.
Yeah, that was a nice little segue. Well, yeah, okay, so Kanye West made some news this week because he's finally on Twitter, of all things. Maybe he's hoping that all of that Twitter effect will help his upcoming album, which he performed pieces of a cappella for Facebook, the employees of Facebook. He visited Facebook, and while standing on a cafeteria, I guess, dining room table, he rapped. Did any of you see the footage from this?
I thought you were telling me that he went to some of his fans' homes who were his friends on Facebook, people who friended him. You're saying he went to the corporate headquarters of Facebook?
Yes.
Well, that's interesting.
That's really bizarre.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was like fans, but he went to Facebook. Okay.
Yeah, in Palo Alto, California.
But this is just another example of the changing, you know, face of media. Instead of going to MTV, he goes to Facebook. You know, you sell 6 million copies of a digital download and you don't go to MTV to perform a song, you go to Facebook.
Well, maybe when his album comes out, it will knock Eminem's album Recovery out of first place, although I would imagine that by then, Eminem will probably still be charting, but not necessarily be number one anymore.
Do we know when his album comes out?
I believe sometime in the fall.
Oh, well, yeah, Eminem will be off the charts by then. But in the fall, he'll also be competing with Michael Jackson, who apparently has a new album coming out in November. And it's not just remixes and tweaks. It's actually 10 new songs that haven't been previously released before, which will come out in November in time for Christmas. So let's see if the Michael Jackson aura, where he was selling millions of copies of albums after he died, continues for new music.
Well, his manager, Frank DeLeo, says that he's got something like 100 unreleased songs in the vault. But frankly, I think that they're unreleased for a reason, because either they're A, not finished, or B, they weren't very good. And so I think that you'll get a lot of curiosity for this first album that's coming out in November. And then with each successive album that they will release, and he's got, I think, a 7-album deal with, or a 10-album deal with Sony. You know, with each new album, you'll get fewer and fewer sales because that curiosity factor will be just completely gone.
Well, that 10 album sales will include stuff like live music and other things that won't depend on new material. But I think you're right. He was not a prolific guy. So he didn't have, it's not like Dylan or Prince where he's just overloaded with material. It was always took him a long time to get to that 10 or 11 songs that would make an album. So the stuff that he's done, like collaborations with Ne-Yo and Akon and will.i.am from the Black Eyed Peas, I doubt that it's incredibly great stuff, or like you say, we probably would have heard about it before. Will you buy it, Karen?
No. That's one of those things. If I heard it was really great, then I would, but I'd have to really be convinced, because I'm with you on this. It doesn't smell very good.
You're not supposed to smell the CDs. You're supposed to put them in your CD player.
I'm just saying.
But so none of you saw this Kanye West rapping on top of the cafeteria table.
I've never even heard of this. Where the hell have I been?
Well, what do you make of his finally getting onto Twitter? This was like a big deal, and frankly, I could have cared less.
I don't think anybody cares.
There's so many celebrities on Twitter right now that who cares if there's yet.
But he should be, shouldn't he, Karen? I mean, if you've got a lot of fans, there's no reason why you shouldn't say, hey, my new single is out or whatever, right?
Yeah, you do have to have a presence on Twitter.
Well, I was at a birthday party over the weekend for a toddler, of all things, because that's how I roll. I hang out with the toddlers. And there were a couple of hip-hop stars there, Ludacris to name one.
Surprised Michael Jackson wasn't there.
I know. I think he was otherwise engaged.
Well, but the toddlers, the kids.
Oh, yeah, well.
Oh!
Yeah, it's a joke I didn't get, mainly because Michael Jackson is no longer alive.
Okay, so Ludacris was there, yeah.
Ludacris was there, and they were all talking about how they communicate with one another via Twitter. They all direct message one another. Like, that's how they communicate. They don't really go through email.
I wonder why.
Probably because they don't know each other's email addresses. But it's really easy to find them on Twitter.
Yeah, and if you're going to DM somebody, you have to both be following each other.
Right.
Which means that celebrities, who probably don't follow a lot of people, gives them an easier way to probably get through all that. But, I can't imagine Twitter, that it wouldn't make me comfortable as a celebrity.
So you would tell your people, hey, this is not the way to communicate. That's not smart.
Yeah. No, yeah, I wouldn't. You know, for things like, hey, I liked your latest album or something like that, I mean, that's fine.
Yeah, but like we say, BlackBerry is so well encrypted, China doesn't even want to allow it in their country. Whereas iPhones and other forms of social interaction, they can crack and get into and follow. So, yeah. You know, if you want to be secure, maybe you should get your BlackBerry back.
Yeah, well, that's actually a very good point.
Yes. And actually, while we're cracking iPhones and jailbreaking BlackBerries, which actually you probably jailbreak the iPhone and crack the BlackBerry, we should probably mention that this week, a very important ruling was made by the Copyright Office about the DMCA, which is the Digital
Millennium... Long overdue.
Yes, Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which was an act, I think, passed in 1997 or 98, which, you know, not to get too technical, but it goes through all of this, you know, whether you're allowed to copy a DVD, whether you're allowed to jailbreak an iPhone, you know, the takedown notices on YouTube, they're all in the DMCA. So here's what the U.S. Copyright Office ruled. They said that, one, defeating a lawfully obtained DVD's encryption for the sole purpose of short, fair use in an educational setting or for criticism was not illegal. So you can take your DVD and make a copy of it. That's what they're saying. But that copy has to be for a legal purpose. You can't...
Right. If you're not a pirate, what you do with the stuff that you buy is fine, and it's your own business. And since people have the fair use right to use short clips from movies and TV shows and books and songs, then you're allowed to break the code of a CD or a DVD to do that, because that's a legal use of it. So all these things that you can do, like saying, I want to use my iPhone on Verizon, it's legal. I want to make a copy of a DVD so I can put a 20-second clip in this mashup video I'm doing, it's legal. And it's a long overdue ruling, having an ebook. Cracking an ebook code so that you can have an ebook read aloud to the blind. Legal, even if the publisher doesn't think you should be able to do it. Anything you can legally do with something, you're allowed to do. And the publisher can't stop you from it. Because what they were doing was saying, well, yeah, you can legally play aloud a book for someone, but not with our stuff. And they're like, no, if it's legal, you can do it. So it's a hugely important decision, and it's long, long overdue.
Well, the U.S. Copyright Office reviews the DMCA every 3 years just for this purpose, to change some of its rules and to revise and maybe even add a few rules. But you just mentioned one of them, Michael, which is that having an ebook read aloud on, say, a Kindle is not against the law, even if that book has controls built into it to prevent that sort of thing from happening.
Right. They want to sell their own audiobook version of the book, even though the reading it aloud version is nothing remotely like that and is strictly a benefit for the blind or somebody with their thing in the kitchen that they want to make breakfast while they listen to their book. It's just a different thing from an audio performance. And yet they said, oh, no, don't allow that function. And the government said, tough. I mean, the copyright owners are so ridiculous. Even people, you know, looking into a video game to check it for security or just investigate how it works, they'd say, oh, that's illegal. It's like, no, it's not. You can't control what people do with something when what they're doing is legal. You want to take open a video game or a DVD and break it down and see how it's built and what they're doing with it? You can.
Right. And now computer programs that allow you to use your phone on a different network, say from AT&T to T-Mobile, that's generally referred to as jailbreaking. You are allowed to do that. Now,
I find all, and I'm scared about myself that I feel this way, but just the very word jailbreaking, hello, that should tell you something. That seems to me that it should be illegal. I mean, in theory, I understand what this on the whole is saying, that it is okay to take parts of DVDs and CDs and books and stuff to use for educational purposes or whatever, but...
Or artistic purposes.
It's the actual physical act of doing it that strikes me as illegal.
Well, but that's what they're saying is not. They're saying as long as your intent is legal, you can do what you want with it.
But just the very act of doing it is illegal. I mean, to me, this strikes me as being very Robin Hood-ish. Like, okay, well, he was helping people, but, you know, he really was stealing stuff. I mean, that's...
You're not stealing something. If you want to
Breaking something apart in a way that not everybody can do. That's what I find... I can't put into words why it bothers me, but there's something about it that doesn't quite feel right.
Well, what bothers me is when a major multimedia corporation says that perfectly legal use of your own product is, you know, they try to stop you from doing it. I used to wanted to make a I was having a Christmas party, and I wanted to make a VCR, VHS tape of, like, clips from Christmas movies and specials. 30 seconds of this, 3 minutes of that, 2 minutes of that, something from It's a Wonderful Life, something from Rudolph the Red, you know, a two-hour tape that I could just put on and have play in the background. But they have it rigged so that your VCR will not play record when you have your DVD player in the player. And it's ridiculous. A, you're not a pirate. You're doing something perfectly legal. They should not have the right to prevent you from doing something perfectly legal.
Right. And jailbreaking is not necessarily doing something illegal. It's just allowing you to place a program that Apple does not certify onto your iPhone.
Imagine if Apple said you couldn't dial this phone number. Oh, no, you can't call them.
I don't disagree with that. But if you take it, if you look at it from, say, like, I can't even believe I'm siding with AT&T. If you look at it from their perspective, they have paid a lot of money to have an exclusive deal with Apple, you know, to use the iPhone. And then if, you know, me being a T-Mobile user decides that I want to use an iPhone and I'm going to jailbreak it, this seems to me, I mean, great, more power to me. If I can figure out how to do that, believe me, I think that's way cool.
You know, but, did you know that if you go to AT&T, and this is not a problem in most countries, so we should say that up front, but if you go to AT&T, you've waited your 2 years, you've got an iPhone, you're no longer under contract, and you said, I'm leaving, I'm going to another network, please unlock my phone, that they have to unlock the phone?
Well, that makes more sense to me.
Right.
Had it for
the
a point,
they don't have to honor things like repairing your phone once you have liberated it or jailbreaked it.
Yeah, no, I know
they don't have, you know, it's just that you do have the right to go elsewhere. But you lose a lot of protection when you do that. You know, you do take risks on your own too when you do that. They don't have to honor the warranty. They don't have to honor a lot of things when you do that. So there's incentives for you to stay with them. And you know, if you want to leave, you can. But you take a financial risk when you do.
Well, now, if Sweden had its way, they would charge you an extra couple of kroner for that phone because they want to start, I guess, taxing or putting a surcharge on drives, hard drives, and telephones, I guess. Huh. And this comes after they have this tax, and it's the same thing in Canada, that when you buy CDs and DVDs, when you buy this media, they put in
blank DVDs.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, blank DVDs and blank CDs. They put in a little extra surcharge, and what they do is they take that surcharge and then deliver it to the artists and copyright holders because they know that the reason you're buying CDs and DVDs is to most likely rip a CD onto it, a music CD, or to burn a copy of a movie. And so it's—
Which you have the right to do, right. Assuming. You know, you tape a movie off a TV show, that sort of thing, or make a mixtape of a CD.
That's kind of, it's a backdoor way of taxing piracy.
Right. Well, they say, all right, we've sold 100 million blank CDs this year, and we've gotten 3 cents a CD, and they figure, well, who was the best-selling artist of the year? Black Eyed Peas, they get this chunk, this artist gets that chunk, and it's a sliding scale so that they sort of assume whoever was most popular sold would probably be the most popular recorded, and therefore they divvy it out among all the artists and acts who were active that year or, you know, or whatever, and give them all a piece of money. And now because people aren't buying recordable CDs or DVDs, they're just, you know, downloading the music onto their hard drive and then putting it on their phone. Now Sweden is saying, well, we better tax the hard drives because we're running out of money. Nobody's buying blank CDs anymore. I haven't bought any in ages.
But they point out here is in 2007, sales of blank discs generated 200 million krona or $28 million for artists compared to last year, only 113 million kroner, which I guess is less. I have no idea how much that is, but it's less than 200 million.
Yeah, but that's a really interesting, but I think we do that even with our blank CDs. We have a tariff on them as well. It's not just in Canada and Sweden. I believe we do that as well, that there's a small amount of the cost of blank CDs that goes to the artists.
Well, you know, maybe what they should really be worried about is not CDs and DVDs and hard drives and phones, but they should be worried about that people aren't going to need any type of media to save their music or their movies on. Like Spotify in Sweden, you know, you can just pay a $10 fee, although in Sweden, I'm sure it's in kroner. You can pay this fee and you subscribe, you can get any song you want. And Spotify, which is in Europe, has been trying to make it into the US and they have had the roughest time negotiating with the labels. However, according to Billboard magazine, what they did was they rebooted their negotiations. So I wonder if that's like a Spider-Man reboot. They just have to hire new actors and a new director. I'm making this joke up on the fly here. But in any case, what they did was they just kind of said, all right, look, let's start over. We've been trying to come to the US for 2 years now, and we've gotten nowhere. And we were originally supposed to launch at the end of 2009. We now hope to launch at the end of 2010. And there are a ton of music companies out there, specifically Warner Music Group, that just does not like this whole quote-unquote freemium model, which kind of gives most of the music away for free. Streaming, you can't download.
It allows you to listen to it. It doesn't give it away. It just allows you access to it for a while until you stop paying.
Right, and it's ad-supported, so the labels would get some kind of revenue for it. You know, what Spotify is supposedly doing, I mean, this is speculation on Billboard's part, is that they are trying to launch a framework that says, okay, look, we'll launch and we'll kind of have a floating contract. We'll kind of review it repeatedly and see what needs to change, what needs to be added or taken away, and they will renegotiate any disputed clauses.
If they want to make it happen, that's what they're going to have to do, I guess.
Right. But I guess what the question is do we really need to own our own music? Do we want to? Or do we just want to rent it for $10 a month from Spotify? Or in the US, there are a couple of services like this. Rhapsody is one of them. MOG, I think, is the name of a service that launched last week, MOG, which looks quite promising. So Spotify might be a little late.
This is a question a lot of people ask. And I think that people initially think that everybody wants to own their own music, but I'm not sure that's really true. I mean, I get tired of songs that I don't think I'd ever want to go back and revisit necessarily. Although you could if you rented it. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I go to the library.
Oh, we're going to be talking about the library in just a moment.
Yeah, I always feel nervous about not owning stuff because I feel like, what if I suddenly bills get too big? We're in a recession and I want to stop paying that $10 monthly fee and suddenly I don't have any music.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
I stop buying music. Now I have nothing.
In a world where Michael Giltz can't listen to music.
In a world where Michael Giltz has an empty iPod. Oh my God,
that's a nightmare.
So for you, Michael, owning your own music is kind of important and a big deal. Whereas for you, Karen, it's kind of a big whoop. You don't really care.
Segway.
Segway alert.
Yes, that was a segue alert. I like the fact that you kind of point them out to our listeners.
That we ruin your segues.
The segueness.
Yes. Yes, you've ruined my segueness. That is our segue into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our lightning round of a segment where we discuss the top entertainment news headlines of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first headline this week is about a very popular book, Blomkvist, Michael Blomkvist. Okay, it's not as catchy as Bond, James Bond, but current Bond on hiatus, Daniel Craig, will be playing the male lead in the English language remake of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. It's based on the best-selling trilogy, which was already turned into a foreign language trio of movies. The first has grossed less than $5 million in the U.S., even though the books have sold 27 million copies worldwide and counting. So obviously, there's room for growth. The female lead is one of the most sought-after roles in years, and now we know the actress who is cast will be standing alongside Daniel Craig. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It would have been a big deal if it wasn't expected that he would get this part.
You knew that he would get this part?
Sure, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. He called me like 3 weeks ago.
I just thought everybody was talking about it. Michael, what do you think?
I think it's a big deal. I mean, James Bond, and he's also in Tintin, the Spielberg and Peter Jackson movies about the adventures of Tintin. And this is just, he's becoming a bigger actor than ever. From a guy who was mocked when he was first cast as James Bond, he's really becoming a major star.
If President Obama needs a gig once he's out of office, maybe he'd consider doing a daytime talk show. When Obama appeared on The View last week, it was the first time a sitting president had appeared on a daytime talk show. He drew the show's biggest audience in its history, 6.9 million people in all. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. Just like it hasn't been news since Clinton went on the Arsenio Hall show, but 6.9 million viewers is their highest gross ever. It's unbelievable. Oprah used to do that every day in the afternoon. That's really not very much.
I'm pretty sure they call that a rating, not a gross, but Karen, what do you think?
I agree. I feel like this should be a big deal, and yet I can't help but think that it really is just a big whoop.
Well, what about Guillermo del Toro? He has chosen his next film. After dropping out of The Hobbit, del Toro has finally announced which of his many projects will be tackled next, and the guy's got a million of them. The answer? At the Mountains of Madness, a classic novella by H.P. Lovecraft that's pure spectacle. How much of a spectacle? James Cameron will be producing, and the film will be shot in 3D.
Yes!
Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop? Never mind, Michael. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Big whoop. Man gets job.
I think it's a big deal. I own this novella. I haven't read it yet, but I bought it because he was looking at it. And I'm going to read it and can't wait to see the movie.
What did Guillermo del Toro call you up and say, Michael, I'm thinking, I don't know, this H.P. Lovecraft story. I really like it. Can you take a look at it for me?
I never read it. And, you know, I wanted to get on the set of The Hobbit. I wanted to do the making of book. I was going to learn Spanish. I would do anything to curry favor with the director of The Hobbit, including reading H.P. Lovecraft. So there you go.
Yeehaw! If four annual celebrations of country music weren't enough for you, don't worry. Fox has announced a fifth annual event, the American Country Music Awards, launching in December. It joins CBS's Academy of Country Music Awards, ABC's Country Music Association Awards, the cable channel CMT's Country Music Television Awards, the Grammys, which were swept by Taylor Swift after all, and ABC's CMA Music Festival, which leads us to ask, why does NBC hate country music so much? Michael, is this a big deal? Or a big whoop?
Well, I'm glad y'all asked me this question. I think it's a big whoop.
Karen?
WTF? What?
Yeah, I mean, that's way overkill. That's just insane.
Don't get me started. Five shows for country music?
For any genre. It doesn't matter. It's a big, probably the biggest genre around almost at the moment, but still, it's stupid.
Yeah, we need to add to this, by the way. It needs to be big deal, big whoop, WTF.
Well, maybe you'll think this next story is a big deal. Pop star Rihanna has had 7 number one singles in the U.S. and yet has not appeared on one country music award show. And that's just in the last 5 years, more than any other artist. But apparently, that's not enough for her. Now, she's tackling the movies. Rihanna was announced as the romantic lead in Battleship, the summer movie blockbuster to be co-starring Taylor Kitsch of Friday Night Lights and Alexander Skarsgård of True Blood. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
With those two guys in it, who cares who the girl is?
I stopped listening when he said Taylor Kitsch.
Me too.
Okay, I'm going to
go. I don't care who the girl is.
for a second there, Karen, I thought you were pulling a Mel Gibson on me with the heavy breathing.
You can do it.
Now, when President Obama was on The View, he admitted that he had never heard of Snooki, of Jersey Shore fame, which is probably good for him, actually. But Obama did know that Lindsay Lohan was in jail. Hopefully, someone will tell the president that Lohan is now out of jail after serving 14 days of a 90-day sentence for violating her probation. Lohan now starts a 3-month stint in rehab. Karen, big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop. I'm so over this girl. I think it was a bigger deal that Obama didn't know who Snooki was. I thought that was really cute.
Michael?
Whoopity whoop.
You know what kills me is the actress was discharged at 1:35 a.m. Monday morning.
They know what they're doing.
What in the...
Of course they wanted to get her out there when there wouldn't be a ton of people around.
Yeah.
To lower the circus level. Absolutely.
That's
smart.
Smart.
I can't even get the city of L.A. to pick up the phone during office hours. And they're at work at 1:35. Okay, moving on. The season 4 premiere of Mad Men hit a record high. Unfortunately for AMC, that only means the show drew 2.9 million viewers. Obviously, that number will rise once DVR users and downloads and the people who wait for the DVD are added in. But still, Michael, is this record high a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal in the sense of how low it is. This show's won best drama 2 years in a row. It's a shame more people aren't watching it.
Karen?
Yeah, but what are you really going to expect with, you know, with all your options? 2.9 is pretty good.
Media fragmentation?
Thank you. That was what I was looking for.
iCarly gets more viewers.
Moving on. The newest savior for quality television? DirecTV. Once upon a time, whenever a quality show was about to be axed, everyone would desperately wonder if HBO would pick it up, even though HBO almost never did rescue a network show. Now people may look to DirecTV. First, it rescued Friday Night Lights by sharing it with NBC. Now it's picked up the Glenn Close drama Damages, which will air solely on DirecTV. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop? I think I know the answer, but go ahead.
I think it's a big deal for, you know, any time that quality television, even if it's only getting 1 or 2 million viewers, can survive and is seen as valuable. That's great.
Karen?
I think it's a big deal for the same reason, but also I think it's really interesting that it's only going to be showed on DirecTV.
They're pushing themselves more as a provider of original programming. Whoever you are, you got to have original programs. Can't get by with reruns.
Yep.
Broadway ticket prices are so expensive, it feels like they're asking you for a pound of flesh just for good seats to Wicked. That problem may only get worse when actor Al Pacino comes to The Great White Way in The Merchant of Venice in the iconic role of Shylock the Jew. Pacino's performance has been standing room only during its summer run for Shakespeare in the Park, the free outdoor offering that makes living in New York bearable. Now it follows Hair and On the Town in making the leap to Broadway. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
What are we big deal, big whooping? The fact that Al Pacino has a job?
Going to Broadway. Classic Shakespearean role.
I don't want that big whoop.
I say it's a big deal because it's another financial risk for the public, which has been trying to find a new moneymaker that it can take to Broadway. You know, it survived for years on the grosses of A Chorus Line. And, you know, Hair and On the Town didn't do great. And this is another one they're going to try and transfer. It's getting dangerous.
Director Terry Gilliam is coming to the web. The mind behind classics like Brazil and Time Bandits will direct the webcast of an Arcade Fire concert at Madison Square Garden. Knowing Gilliam's cursed luck with actors, the band might want to take out some health insurance, just in case. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. I assume he's doing it just because he's a fan of the band. You know, if you were actually drawing major talent to direct webcasts, that would really be stunning. But I assume it's just being done for fun.
Karen?
Which, to me, makes it a big deal. Good for him.
And I can tell you, having seen Arcade Fire Live, they are awesome.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully they won't walk off stage, though.
Yes.
Hopefully they'll clear any pigeons from the rafters of Madison Square Garden before Arcade Fire's show. That wasn't the case for Kings of Leon. They had to cancel a St. Louis concert on Friday at the Verizon Wireless Amphitheater, which apparently is free of wires, but not free of pests. In a scene out of Monty Python, very good Terry Gilliam reference there, the opening act came off stage, literally covered in pigeon droppings. Kings of Leon tried to go on anyway, but when they got hit repeatedly, and one pigeon even splattered the mouth of, is it singer Michael Jarrett or bassist Michael Jarrett?
I don't know. I thought I looked him up as being a singer as well as bassist. I think they all sing.
Yeah, well, they all got covered in bird excrement too. They called it a day after three songs. Karen, big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's really funny.
Michael?
I wish there was video of this. Oh, golly, I think I just found some pigeon poops on Kings of Leon.
Yes.
Well, if we can find some good poop, we'll post it for you.
Well, I can tell you that normally, I mean, pigeon infestations at concert venues are kind of a well-known problem. And they usually
really? I've never heard of such a thing.
Yeah, well, because the venue usually hires somebody to come in with a hawk that chases away or eats all the pigeons. So this is really the venue's fault. Moving on. What's the number one place people get DVDs from? Is it Netflix? Redbox? Amazon? Maybe it's Blockbuster? Nope. It's the library. In a new study, public libraries in the U.S. loan out an average of 2.1 million DVDs every day, which is more than the 2 million shipped by Netflix, the 1.4 million picked up at Redbox, and the 1.2 million rented at Blockbuster. Karen, I believe I know the answer to this, but is this a big deal or a big whoop?
You tell me what you think I'm going to say.
Big deal.
This is a huge deal. It's the library.
Yeah, it's free.
It's so cool.
Michael?
I agree. I've been in the Heartland a lot in the last year, and I was going to the library and getting DVDs all the time. So it's a big deal. And, you know, it only increases in times of recession. So all the more reason we should not cut funding for libraries and keep them open late.
Well, in a related story, Redbox is going to start renting Blu-ray discs for $1.50.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
They shouldn't actually, it doesn't make sense. I take that back.
They
because you shouldn't charge extra for it.
Yeah, I agree with that. Well, that brings us to our listener email. And we have a note here from our good friend, Aaron Rich of Brooklyn. He writes,
we know him?
Yes, we do.
He emailed us before.
Yes. Nice memory there, Karen, by the way.
Sorry.
He writes to us, hey guys, I just read a few things on Ebert's blog about Inception, and he pointed out that the film is currently number 3, technically tied with a 9.1 rating for first place, but with many fewer votes on the IMDb top 250 list based on viewer ratings. So what he's trying to say is, it's in the top 250 list on IMDb. Toy Story 3 is in 8th place with a score of 8.8. Of course, this is an incredibly arbitrary rating system. Only people who feel strongly about a film will vote for it. So you probably have a ton of people who give it 10 out of 10 and then a few who give it 0 out of 10. But it is interesting to note that this, The Dark Knight, and Memento are all in the top 30 and all ahead of Citizen Kane, North by Northwest, Sunset Boulevard, and It's a Wonderful Life. I guess audiences love Christopher Nolan, and he provides a link to the top 250 list on IMDb. Keep up the good work, Aaron. I think it's fascinating.
I think it's interesting that Inception was marketed as a Christopher Nolan film and not as a Leonardo DiCaprio movie.
I agree. That was totally his coming of age. I mean, obviously, The Dark Knight was so big that was why they did it. But it's clearly put him into the first rank with critics and audiences. And obviously, Aaron's right. It's such an arbitrary ranking thing on IMDb. So it's not a great list if you're looking for – go to my list of the best movies of all time.
There you go.
And you know what? All the people who would have voted North by Northwest or Sunset Boulevard –
they're old.
Yes. They're either not on the
internet.
They
don't know how to turn on their computer.
Right.
my father says – my dad, every time he goes towards the settings, I'm like, do not go into the settings. If he goes into the settings, we can never fix his computer. It takes us days. Stay away from the settings. Old man.
What's remarkable to me is that this guy who used to be my neighbor when I lived in the Hollywood Hills, I mean, he was just this like shy guy who would have dinner at the local diner because, you know, I'd be eating alone and he'd be eating alone and he would be very kind of understated. And I always thought, I think that guy is Christopher Nolan. And it turns out not only is he Christopher Nolan, he's my neighbor and now he's his big time director.
That's so cool.
Another wasted opportunity. Come on, Sperling.
I know. I just can't. Well, you know what? Maybe. Maybe I
podcast the movie.
I'm going to hold on. I'm just dialing Mr. Nolan up now. Okay. Anyway, we should move on to Inside Baseball, our weekly segment where we discuss only the stories that Hollywood might care about. And this week, actually, only Hollywood really might care about this. Turns out Richard Branson's interested in making movies. His Virgin Group is going to be launching a production arm in conjunction with Relativity Media. Or I should say Relativity Media's Rogue, which they purchased from, I believe, Universal Pictures. And then a week or so ago, they bought Overture from Starz, and they cut that deal with Netflix to distribute their DVDs day and date with the DVD release. They're just like on a tear, this Relativity Media. Why, you ask? Even though you didn't ask. Probably because Ryan Kavanaugh wants to go public. He wants to take Relativity Media public. He said that, quote, down the road, we'll be looking at several options, one of which could be a public offering. And he said that to Bloomberg in an interview, but he had no timetable for it. What I found either interesting or depressing was that who is going to be the head of this new arm called Virgin Produced?
Who?
Justin Bearfield.
The kid from Malcolm in the Middle?
Right. And I'm like, wait, he's what? Not a child anymore? That's...
He's a smart kid. He's a smart guy. He's been producing stuff for a while now, hasn't he?
Yes, but nothing that has been successful. So I don't know why they put him in charge, along with his producing partner, Jason Feltz. You know what? I'm going to give him a call and tell him that I'm lining up Christopher Nolan for Podcast the Movie. Meanwhile, all of you listening out there can email us your thoughts, comments, missives to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T. @showbizsandbox.com. If you want to call us, you could do that too. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's toll free, 888-567-7263. Of course, you can find links to all of the stories we talked about on today's episode on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by MGMT, the popular indie rock group who can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com. Karen Woodward can be found, well, I guess on her website. KarenWoodwardOnline.com is her website, and she is on Twitter. @Karen_Woodward is her username. Michael's on Twitter. His username is @MichaelGilt, incredibly easy to remember. And if you can remember it there, you could also visit his website, MichaelGilt.com, where you can find links to all of his writing. I'd like to thank our guest, Daniel Frankel from The Wrap. We will place links to his Twitter account and his post on the Twitter Effect in our show notes. I'm on Twitter, @Sperling is my username. You can also find some of my writing on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.